Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present John Nichols of The Nation magazine, who assesses the reaction to Wisconsin Senator Russ Feingold's resolution of censure targeting President Bush for his warrantless spying on Americans' international phone and email communications. Iman Ahmad Kamas, an Iraqi member of the Women Say No to War tour, now traveling the United States, who explains what she believes is fueling sectarian violence in her country and why she is calling for an end to the American occupation. And Miles Rappaport, president of the group Demos, who examines America's growing income inequality. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
In recent weeks, the genocide in Darfur, the western province of Sudan, has spilled over the border into neighboring Chad, creating more political unrest in the heart of Africa. Former U.S. Marine Brian Steidel saw the horror in Darfur firsthand. He worked for a year with the African Union's peace monitoring group. Often, Steidel watched but could not stop dozens of attacks by the Sudanese-backed militias, the Janjaweed, with the support of Sudanese helicopters. When he returned to the U.S., Steidel caused a stir by releasing aerial photographs documenting the genocide in Darfur that has killed an estimated 400,000 people and displaced over 2.5 million Darfur residents. This spring, Steidel is on a 22-city speaking tour promoting Million Voices for Darfur, a year-long grassroots campaign to urge 1 million people to send postcards to President George Bush demanding quick action on Darfur. On April the 30th, thousands of religious, civic, and human rights activists will gather at the National Mall in Washington, D.C. for the rally to stop genocide. In an interview with the news magazine In These Times, Steidel insisted the 7,000-member African Union monitoring force was nearly powerless to stop the violence. To break the siege of the militias, Steidel is urging the United Nations to send in a peacekeeping force of 20,000 with strong backing from Western nations. Such a force must be authorized by the UN Security Council, which has requested a plan of action from UN Secretary General Kofi Annan. On March the 17th, the Islamic regime in Iran released leading dissident Akbar Ganji from jail 2 weeks before the end of his 6-year prison sentence. Ganji's release came unexpectedly as the Iranian security service dropped him off at his house at 10 p.m. at night. He was arrested in April 2000 for writing a series of articles exposing high-level security officials who were involved in the assassination of political dissidents. Security forces have closed more than 100 pro-reform newspapers since his arrest and harassed a growing number of web bloggers in Iran. While in jail, Ganji advocated a boycott of the 2005 presidential election won by hardliner Mahmoud Ahmadinejad. He also issued a manifesto calling for turning Islamic Iran into a secular democracy. Now 46, Ganji was a true believer in the early days of the Islamic Revolution. He joined the Republican Guard and spied on Iranian students in Turkey. By the late 1990s, he became a strong reformer. According to the Washington Post, in mid-March, Iranian authorities released a number of dissidents from jail, including 8 members of a bus driver's union who had launched a strike. Iranian reformers say 40 political prisoners remain in jail. For 16 years, Heather McDonald and Carol Snyder had lived as a lesbian couple in suburban Westchester County, New York. Their same-sex relationship became an issue when a nurse objected to McDonald sitting at Snyder's bedside after a breast cancer operation. Now the lesbian couple is joining other gay plaintiffs in filing a lawsuit against New York State for the right to marry. According to USA Today, this is one of a series of lawsuits in various states brought by the American Civil Liberties Union and the gay rights group Lambda Legal Defense and Education Fund in states supportive of gay rights. The goal is to win state court decisions legalizing same-sex marriage. The lawsuits are based on the historic ruling by the state Supreme Court in Massachusetts that created the right to same-sex marriage. The state-by-state approach was also used by gay rights advocates to overturn the ban on sodomy. In 2003, the U.S. Supreme Court declared that laws banning sex amongst homosexuals was unconstitutional. 19 states have passed bans on gay marriage, and the question will be on the ballot in 7 states in this fall's election. Nationally, opposition to gay marriage seems to be softening. A poll by the Pew Research Center shows a slim majority opposing same-sex marriage, a decline of 12 points from 2004. The Pew poll also found growing acceptance of adoption by gay couples and a strong majority in favor of gays and lesbians serving openly in the military. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Indu Anand.
President Bush's admission that he ordered warrantless surveillance of U.S. citizens' international phone and email communication over the past 4 years captured national headlines, but the Republican-controlled Congress seems eager to legitimize the apparent illegal action. GOP Senators DeWine, Graham, Hagel, and Snow have sponsored legislation that would retroactively make legal the president's refusal to seek court warrants required under the 1978 Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act. But the issue took a surprising turn when Senator Russ Feingold, a Wisconsin Democrat, introduced a resolution on March 13th that would censure President Bush for authorizing the warrantless spy program conducted by the National Security Agency. However, only 2 Democratic senators, Barbara Boxer of California and Tom Harkin of Iowa, stepped forward to co-sponsor the measure. The U.S. Senate has only censured a president once, Andrew Jackson, back in 1834. A Newsweek poll taken March 16th and 17th found that 50% of those surveyed opposed censuring Bush, while 42% supported it, but 60% of Democrats polled favored censure. The Senate Judiciary Committee is set to begin hearings on Feingold's motion on March 31st. Between the Lines' Scott Harris spoke with John Nichols, Washington correspondent for The Nation magazine. Nichols examines the reasons why so many Democrats have run away from Feingold's motion of censure.
It is very tragic what I think has happened over the last 2 weeks for the Democratic Party, because they were given an opportunity to do 2 things. One, politically define themselves as a clear opposition party, a party that stands for a basic set of principles, and something that we know from polling the majority of Americans agree with. They could have taken that stand. They didn't. They refused to back Feingold on his censure motion. 2, though, at the same time, in failing to do what was politically smart, they also failed to do what was right for the nation. And that's where it gets really scary. Because when you are in a moment where the opposition party won't even do the right thing if it's good for the country, you end up asking yourself, I mean, what do we do? How do we get out of this mess? Now, some wise folks will counsel that maybe we ought to, go for a third-party route. And I'm very sympathetic to that, except that really outside of a handful of places around the country, third parties don't begin to be viable. They don't have the resources, the ballot position, the capacity to do it. And so we're stuck in a very bad place as a country. And I think that the Feingold challenge has really put a lot of pressure back on activists to make a tough call and to do something very bold, which is to go into Democratic primaries around the country and pull the lever for the opposition, pull the lever for somebody who's going to try and change the thing. And that means opposing a number of sitting incumbents, and also in open primaries, choosing the candidate who says that they'll back censure, that they'll oppose the Patriot Act, that they're for a timeline for withdrawal from Iraq. And if they're not, don't back them in the primary, but also really ask yourself whether they deserve backing in November. It's that serious a situation, because this party is clearly not waking up, and it runs the risk, the very real risk, of repeating the exact same set of mistakes that were made in 2002 and in 2004, when the Republicans didn't win, the Democrats lost. And if they do it again in this cycle, at this point in the nation's history, giving George Bush two more years of really uncontrolled presidency, unrestrained presidency with no checks and balances, I think they will have done not just their party, but the American experiment an extreme disservice.
John Nichols, I just want you to dissect the timidity of the Democrats for a moment here, because it's said by the political strategists that support for this censure resolution by Russ Feingold could wake up, could energize Republican Party voters and thereby diminish the chances that the Democrats could win the House or Senate come the November midterm elections. What do you make of that reading of the tea leaves?
If the Republican Party really thought that Russ Feingold's censure initiative was going to help the Republican Party, they would have shut up and let the Democrats do it. They would have pretended they were terribly scared and led the Democrats into the trap, because they would have wanted it not to simply be Russ Feingold raising the issue. They would have wanted a lot of other Democrats to get on board. Instead, even before Russ Feingold had formally filed his censure motion, Republicans were going wild. They were sending emails all over the country. They had a whole website developed attacking Feingold. They were preparing to air ads in Wisconsin attacking Feingold, even though Feingold wasn't up for election. So it was clear from the start that the Republicans knew that what Feingold was doing was actually a very serious political threat to them, and they wanted to create the fantasy, spin the fantasy, that it would be something that would energize their base and that this would be harmful to the Democrats, because they wanted to scare the Democrats off. Unfortunately, most Washington Democrats are so dumb and so susceptible to Karl Rove's spin that they fell for it. They did, in fact, back off. And the amazing thing about it was when they went out and polled this stuff, despite the fact that the whole Democratic leadership avoided the issue, that there's been virtually no education on this issue whatsoever, that Feingold's been the only person speaking out for it, basically, and that even he has not had that good a national platform. But even without that national exposure, we find in polling that it's an even split on censure. Imagine if the Democrats had embraced the issue and actually talked it up and educated people about the need for it, about why this is a good idea, and why it is not a particularly dangerous thing to do, why it's absolutely appropriate and necessary in the current moment. I think the polling numbers would be through the roof, but even without that, we've got a tie. And the incredible thing was that in polling on censure, several of the polling companies also threw in an impeachment question. What they found was that the majority of Democrats favor impeachment, but also that 42% of independents, without any education on the issue, without any real national discussion on the issue, favor impeaching George Bush at this point. 42% of independents. The fact of the matter is, the American people are totally ready for an accountability moment with George Bush. They are totally ready to hold this guy's feet to the fire.
That was John Nichols, Washington correspondent with The Nation magazine. Read Nichols' columns online at www.thenation.com. Nichols is co-author, along with Robert McChesney, of the book Tragedy and Farce: How American Media Sell Wars, Spin Elections, and Destroy Democracy. As violence and chaos seem to increase daily in Iraq, a group of Iraqi women have come to the U.S. as part of the Women Say No to War tour, sponsored by Code Pink and other peace organizations. They arrived just before International Women's Day, March 8th, and the five women are spending up to 6 weeks traveling the U.S. individually with U.S. hosts in order to maximize the number of Americans they can reach. Among the Iraqi women on the U.S. tour is Iman Ahmad Kamas, a journalist, English professor at Baghdad University, and activist who is making her first trip to America. She is a member of the Women's Will organization, which defends women's rights. For the past 3 years, she has been documenting crimes committed by U.S. and Iraqi forces in her country. She is the former director of International Occupation Watch Center Baghdad and is married with two daughters. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhus spoke with Iman Kamas, who explains what she believes is fueling sectarian violence in her country and why she is calling for an end to the American occupation.
People who attend the public meetings, they listen, they ask. You can see that they are sincere. They want to know what's happening, and they want to decide for themselves too what to do about this, because it's you also. The American people are also involved in this. Your sons and daughters are being killed. You worry your money is spent there, etc.
In terms of the sectarian differences between the Sunnis and the Shiites, I've read different things from Iraqis saying that that issue is not such a big problem, certainly the way it's portrayed in the U.S. And ever more now escalating this violence that is portrayed as between Sunnis and Shias and portrayed as coming stemming from those sectarian differences, that, you know, there's worry that the country's going to devolve into civil war if it hasn't already. How do people in Iraq see those differences? I've also heard that there's a fair amount of intermarriage between Shias and Sunnis. And
definitely.
Okay, so how big a problem is that? Is it a problem?
It is a problem, but it is at the same time exaggerated here. But again, the danger is there, especially in last month after the blast of the mosque. As one of the American magazines called, I think it was Time magazine, called it the breaking point. Well, Iraq was broken in March 2003, not now. First of all, we never had civil war in Iraq, in our history, I mean. We never had civil war. This is the first time that we hear this talk. No Iraqi would kill another Iraqi because he is a Kurd or because he is a Shia or because he is Sunni or a Christian or Muslim. We never have this. The biggest tribe in Iraq, which is called Al-Jaburi, half of it are Sunnis and the other half are Shia. Many Iraqi women, three of the Iraqi women who are in this delegation, who are in the U.S. now, one of them, her mother is Shia, her father is Sunni. The second one, herself, is Sunni. Her husband is Shia from Najaf. The third one is Shia from Hilla, and her husband is Sunni from Baghdad. I don't care if I was Shia, Sunni, Kurd, Arab. I don't care. I just care. I'm Iman and I'm Iraqi. That's it. This is my identity. So, and all the women who are here and there in Iraq, they don't care. It is irrelevant to be Sunni or Shia. And many men also. This issue of Sunni and Shia, etc., is something that is worked on by the militias, by the political parties who are using the religious and sectarian emotions and feelings of people to work on political agendas.
What do you think should happen in Iraq? Do you think that the U.S. should pull out immediately? And if so, what do you think would happen afterwards?
First, the American government has to announce immediately now at this moment that the occupation is going to be ended in Iraq and that all the troops and all the military bases are going to be pulled out of Iraq, let's say in a month, in 2 months, but not years. And during that, they should allow the Iraqis themselves to work on creating a government, creating a body that runs the country during this transitional period, and to give some room, some space to the international community, to the United Nations, to the Arab League, to the Islamic Conference, Congress, whatever. I mean, there are other peoples on this planet, not only the American, because the American always said, if we go out, are you going to kill each other? No, no.
How much of the violence do you think is directly related to the American presence in Iraq?
Oh, much. All of it, actually. Either directly because they bomb, they shoot, or indirectly because they unleash these militias and these fanatics and these terrorists. So according to international law, the Americans are responsible for the security of Iraq. They are responsible as occupiers for the security in the country that they occupy. So they are responsible 100%, either directly or indirectly.
That was Iman Ahmad Kamas, an Iraqi member of the Women Say No to War Tour. Contact Code Pink, which is organizing the tour, by calling area code 310-827-4320 or visit their website at www.womensaynotowar.org. America has an ugly secret, the growing gap between rich and poor. But while economic inequality in the U.S. is known to much of the world, our nation's citizens remain largely in the dark about the increasing concentration of wealth, which has eroded the once thriving American middle class. The devastation resulting from Hurricane Katrina last fall briefly exposed the large numbers of poor people living in New Orleans and the Gulf Coast region. But sustained media coverage of the institutional causes of poverty has largely been absent. Economists point to the rising cost of health care, education, and housing, disappearing pensions, and the outsourcing of high-paying jobs as several sources of inequality. But tax policies favoring the wealthy and a weakened labor movement have also contributed to a growing class divide. Demos, a group that combines research and advocacy to strengthen American democracy, has recently published a book exploring this topic titled Inequality Matters: The Growing Economic Divide in America and Its Poisonous Consequences. Contributors to the book, who write about the political and social dimensions of economic disparity, include Barbara Ehrenreich, William Grider, Charles Lewis, and Bill Moyers. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Miles Rappaport, president of Demos, who examines America's growing inequality.
About a year and a half ago, Demos sponsored a conference here in New York that was about inequality, and Bill Moyers served as keynote speaker. And we were all struck by just how widespread and really frightening the issue of increasing inequality in America had become, and we decided to put it into a book. So it took about a year to put it together. But what it is a remarkable collection of essays that I think document how, bit by bit, little by little, inequality has become a real cancer in American society, and that we are now more unequal as a society than we have been at any time since 1929. And what's happened is that according to David K. Johnston in one of the chapters, the Great Tax Shift, in the last 35 years, since 1970, the income of the bottom 90% of America's population has actually fallen by about 5%. In the meantime, the incomes of the top 10% have risen 89%, but beyond that, the gains are totally, totally concentrated among the very, very top, the 0.01%, 13,400 households alone saw their incomes balloon by about 8 times since 1970 and are now making $24 million a year. So what's happened is that the poor have lost ground. The middle class, which I want to come back to, is really in jeopardy. And a tiny, tiny minority of really, really wealthy people have done fabulously well. And I don't think that's the America that our founding fathers envisioned. I don't think it's the America that those of us who care about people really want.
What are some of the issues in terms of tax policy as regards pensions, that have contributed so greatly to the growing inequality in the U.S.?
The real crowning achievement of the United States in the middle of the last century was the creation of a huge, widespread middle class that was really the envy of the world. After World War II, thanks to the GI Bill, thanks to mortgage subsidies, thanks to a variety of policies, Social Security, we really had a society in which the economic inequalities began to lessen. Now, what's happened is that over the last 30 years, really, the pillars of that society have been yanked or pulled at one by one. So in 1955, the largest single private employer in America was General Motors. If you got out of high school and got a job with General Motors, you made about $18 an hour in inflation-adjusted dollars, had health care for life, and a permanent pension. Today, the largest single private employer is Walmart, and that's about a $7.15 an hour pay, no benefits for most employees, certainly no pension, and you get a very, very different picture. So what's happening is that where it was possible 30, 40, 50 years ago, for a family to become a middle-class family with one wage earner, now we have two-income families working, struggling to make ends meet, going deeper into debt, and facing, I think, for the first time, being the first generation in which our children will be less well-off than we are. And I think that's a sad commentary and something that ought to be front and center in American politics.
Miles, when it comes to issues of race, again, it seems to be a set of problems that we have here in America that are really not at the top of any political agenda, but yet they certainly play a very poisonous role in inequality in this country still to this day, regardless of Civil Rights Act and the Voting Rights Act and such.
Well, I think that, you know, now we are 50 years beyond the Brown versus Board of Education, 40 years past the Voting Rights Act of 1965. And yet what we see is that the conditions that millions of African Americans and immigrants and Latino citizens find themselves in hasn't changed nearly as much as one would have expected. Right now, an African American earns about 59 cents on the dollar of what a white American earns. In 1963, when Martin Luther King made his speech, it was 57 cents. So small progress indeed, and we need to do a lot better. Unfortunately, I think one of the things that the book highlights tremendously is that when we look at the gap in wealth and accumulated wealth over generations, going back to the, you know, and for many families, the 1800s, for some families, the early 1900s, the gap between the wealth available to whites and to blacks is dramatically different, about 10 to 1, far greater than the income divide. So we've got a lot of continuing work to do. But I think what's happening, interestingly, is that it's no longer a question of, well, we have a vast majority of people who are doing well and just a small number of people who are left behind. I think what the book points out, the inequalities and the policies that have been undertaken over the last 20 or 30 years, show that there's now a very tiny minority of people who have jumped way ahead of the rest of us. A vast majority of people who are not doing well or suffering from economic insecurities of various kinds, including a vast buildup of credit card debt, for instance. And I think that that's a political situation and a social situation in our country that really can't be allowed to stand. And I think people of goodwill and people who are just saying, how's my family going to get by, are starting to say it's really time for a change.
That was Miles Rappaport, president of Demos and a contributor to the book Inequality Matters: The Growing Economic Divide in America and Its Poisonous Consequences. Contact Demos at area code 212-633-1405 or visit their website at www.demos.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced at the studios of WPKN Radio and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines by calling area code 203-331-9756 or write to Between the Lines, care of WPKN Radio, 244 University Avenue, Bridgeport, Connecticut, 06604. Visit our website at www.btlonline.org to hear our current and archived programs in MP3 and real audio. There you can subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mika Ta. This week's program is produced by Scott Harris with the assistance of Indu Anand, Bill Cosentino, Chris Ferriero, Hank Hoffman, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Denise Manzari.